This is Oral History 1120, the WITS 40th Anniversary Project. Today it's Alison Murchie interviewing Joe Cheshire at the State Library. It's the 4th of April 2018. First off, Joe, thank you very much for coming along and agreeing to be part of our project. We really do appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
So first off, I just need to get some technical details. So what's your full name?
Full name is Josephine Anne Cheshire, yeah.
And is that your, what's your maiden name?
Goss, G-O-S-S.
And your date and place of birth?
Port Lincoln. It was the 20th of November 1945. It was actually on the stroke of midnight.
Yeah. So you can pick your birthday almost?
Well, it was a bit of confusion. My dad went up the next morning and thought, well, that must have been the day. So I was registered on that day. But Mum decided that she would have it the day before. So my whole life I've had
birthdays. You've had two birthdays, so just enjoy and get double presents. So did you grow up in Port Lincoln?
I did, yeah. My dad was one of the fishing pioneers over there, so I grew up around the water.
What sort of fishing?
Yeah. Shark and cray. He went out. He was one of the pioneers and looked out the cray fishing grounds, the sharking grounds. Mm. Yeah, very, very basic old wooden boats. Nothing like the high-tech vessels they have these days. Totally different world.
So did you grow up on a strong seafood diet?
We did, to the point that, you know, he'd come home with wheat bags full of crayfish and I'd say to Mum, what's for dinner tonight? And she'd go, oh, crayfish. And I'd go, oh, no, can I please go to the shop and get some frits? I would be begging for frits. But, yeah, so, yes, we had plenty. But
so you were quite spoiled if you look at it from today's perspective.
Yeah, I was. Yeah.
What about your mum?
My mum came from, both of them came from the Adelaide Hills. Mum was one of the Harndorf Lutherans, came out on one of the very early ships. And then ended up living in a shack, literally on the sand in Coffin Bay, as a young mum. So, yeah, her life was pretty hard. Yeah, washing nappies in the sea, and yeah.
that's only one generation away. That's a very tough life, isn't it?
It's crazy. Yeah, when you think to go into the hospital, she went in a horse and cart on bush tracks, and I came home from hospital on a wooden fishing cutter round the coast from Port Lincoln. So yeah, it's a totally different world, and yet only 70 years ago.
Yeah, I'm saying one generation.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you have any brothers and sisters?
One younger sister.
So what were your early years like growing up over there?
Well, it's funny, the word that first came to mind was ragged, and I guess ragged in that we were just completely like urchins and we played on the beach and we built cubbies in the scrub and we had our own names for the different wildflowers. Yeah, it was a very basic, happy, simple childhood. Loved it.
And that's really extended into your adulthood, where you're still a really outdoors person, aren't you?
Yes, and maybe because I'm now such a passionate bushwalker, and that might be it. You know, I just love
going out
in the bush.
Because that's the way you grew up.
Yeah.
And how long did you stay at Lincoln?
First moved away at the age of 18, came to Adelaide to work, and from then on, it seems to be if you grew up on the west coast around Lincoln, you keep going back. So for years I lived there, here, and lived a lot of my married life over there. But I've been back here now. Adelaide's my home with maybe two trips to Lincoln every year.
You still go every year?
Still go every year. Still have a Christmas.
Home calls.
Yeah. It's good to go home.
You came to Adelaide 18. Did you have a job lined up?
Yes, I was working for Clarkson's over there, and then they were the glass people in those days, and then came and worked for them here. Yeah.
What were you doing?
Doing admin work, yeah.
And I'm making probably an educated guess, it wasn't a lot of work for young women and growing up in the country, was there?
No.
Other than in a few set areas.
Yes, it was very much, when you went to school, you did commercial or you did science, and I did commercial. So it was reception work, office work, yeah.
That sets you up for a much wider range of employment too, doesn't it?
Well, it did, yeah.
How did you feel about moving to Adelaide?
Well, I was pretty excited. I remember I came to live with my aunt and uncle at Tranmere, and I remember the first day coming into the city that I had never been in the city that I could remember. And the bus was heading down, and I saw tall buildings, and I said, "Is this the city?" to the bus driver, and he said, "Well, dear, this is Hackney. I'll tell you when it's time to get off." So that was my first day at work, thinking that Hackney must have been the city because it didn't get much bigger
lovely.
Than that. Yeah. Yeah.
And your job was clerical work? Or?
Yes, yes.
And you settled in IK to Adelaide Life?
Yeah, I did. I was pretty excited by the whole thing. It was back in the days of, you know, dancing in the sand down on the beach and being a surfy, and yeah, it was all very beachy.
It was a good time to grow up, wasn't it?
It was brilliant. Yeah, I loved it.
Now, the reason we've got you here is because somehow or other you got to WIS. And I'm not defining what WIS is, because everyone that's listening to this will know about the project.
Yeah.
What led you to leaving Clarkson's?
I went from there to Thompson and Harvey, and I was the PA to one of the directors there, who was just a gorgeous man. And from there, I ended up going back to Lincoln. So then from there I came and went. Ended up coming back to Adelaide and going to uni as a mature age student with three of
Adelaide Uni?
Adelaide Uni and Flinders. Went to a bit of both. And, three of my own kids and one of their friends who wanted to come as well. So it was, you know, four country kids and me. And we all headed over and, yeah, I went to uni, which was amazing.
What made you decide to go to uni? Because you could have gone at 18, but you probably hadn't thought about it as a country kid. In those days, not a lot of country kids necessarily had the aim of a university education, did they?
Would never have occurred to me, no. I guess it was a progression from realising that I loved writing and starting to get a bit creative with my writing, and then doing a creative writing course through TAFE. And I think through that made me sort of link into, maybe I can, you know, do a bit more. And then decided I'd go to uni and did a English history double major degree, and then a year as in English honours. Yeah.
What did you major in?
I majored in, my thesis was on the novels, the father figure in the novels of Janet Turner Hospital. For some reason, I picked her. So, yeah, I found that was really interesting because I had a bit of an interest in psychology too. Might have done that, except you had to do maths and stats, so I didn't. But
so your creativity was finding an avenue now.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, so you've got your uni, got your degree, got your honours.
Yeah.
What next?
That's what I thought. What next? I was, maybe had better get a grown-up kind of job. And then someone said, if you went and did library information management in a fast-tracked 12-month postgrad degree, you'd get a job. So I thought, maybe I better do that. So I started doing it, discovered that perhaps I wasn't meant for the Dewey system. We just didn't click. I remember one of the tutorials was I had to go and interview someone from a community information place. And by this time, I was very jaded with the whole thing, and went along. And it happened, I went to WIS, and I remember that Stella Hollander was the person that interviewed me, and she was just so wonderful. So we chatted away, and I asked her. I said, "Look, what's your staffing set up here? How does that work?" And she said, "Well, we have volunteers, and we have paid staff." And blah, blah, blah. And I went, okay, how does your volunteer program work? How do you become a volunteer? And she went, well, you fill in a form. And I said, well, do you have a form? And she said, well, yes, this is the form. And I said, fantastic.
So you filled it out.
And I thought, my God, I am now going to be a uni dropout, and I'm going to go volunteering at WIS. And that's what I did. I was out of my library information management
course. But you'd found something you liked.
And I loved it. I just fell into WIS like I was going home. I absolutely loved it.
What year now? Can you remember?
Gosh, now I should have thought of this before I came in because I don't remember. At a stab in the dark, I'd say it would be maybe... 1990, a bit before. I could work that out.
Well, look at the ballpark, so around there. So you would have started when it was next door to where we're sitting now.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was called the switchboard.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
What was it that attracted you? Okay, I can understand that your degree didn't work for you and you were looking for something creative.
Maybe it was the warmth I felt when I walked in there. It was. It just had a lovely feeling. Stella Hollander is just, she's like a walking smile and warmth, and she was just so lovely. And
what was her role?
She was one of the paid staff there, so she would have been an information officer. And she just made it sound like, yeah, this is a welcoming place, this is a helpful place, this is a place where you can be actually doing something that I imagined you would love, but that was really necessary and that would be really helping other people. So it just seemed to tick all the boxes for me of a place where it would be good to be. And much better than trying to handle the Dewey system and sit in a big lecture theatre thinking, I don't even know enough to ask the questions, let alone get the answer, you know, but there I did.
So what you're telling me is you felt you were going to be useful in this organisation as well as loving that workplace.
Yeah, I did. I felt like it was a place I had something to offer that would be worthwhile, but I was going to get a lot of enjoyment and satisfaction and warmth back from it.
Remember those early weeks there? What sort of training were you given and advice on what you were expected to do as a volunteer?
I guess the first thing was to look at the breadth of what they did. They had so many, and would still have even more now, so many different community services that could be linked into to help women. I was also quickly aware of the wide range of needs and wants and expressions that women had, that there was such a need for that place. So I guess that's it. It was this is learning on one hand of everything there is out there to help women, on the other hand, learning that there is so much that women needed.
And in your own life, being totally unaware of that need.
Mm.
Because most of us, unless we actually need one of those services, are totally oblivious to how hard it is for some women. And and that's the role that WIS plays and has continued and has continued to grow. But you were there in those very early years. I'm just trying to... Let me check my notes as to when it started. It was very, very early, wasn't it?
Yes, I was there when I remember Carmel O'Loughlin was the director.
I'm actually interviewing Carmel. She does send her best wishes.
Oh, we'll give her
1978,
my love.
1978, it started here.
Yeah.
So, and Carmel would have been there. So Carmel was running it at that stage?
Carmel was the director for the Status of Women, it used to be called then. Yep. I think that's changed now. That was
dropped
the correct
title then.
Thea Prios was the manager when I started.
How do you spell?
V-A-I-A, I think, and Prius, I think, is P-R-I-O-U-S or S.
Yeah, I know the name. I'm sure we've got that written somewhere. So, and what was her role?
She was managing. WIS at the time. Another warm, funny, friendly, supportive. The women there were just... Marvellous women.
How many paid staff were there at that time?
Well, there would have been Thea, Stella. I think there was another one. Not many,
so
maybe
three or four.
Not many.
And there was a substantial number of volunteers because obviously you were working different days.
Yes, yeah.
Did you work on the same day, work with the same volunteer people, or did you work with a range of people?
I worked with a range of people. There are a few that come to mind. So obviously I must have spent more time with them than others, but I remember there was quite a range of women. No, it's interesting that I can't really remember the volunteers as well as I can remember the paid staff, which makes me think, obviously, I was working with them all the time.
How often did you work?
When I started off volunteering, I would imagine it was probably one afternoon a week, but that's just a guess.
And did that increase or your role change?
My role changed. It's one of those things where I followed Joseph Campbell a bit, who was a devotee of Carl Jung. And in one of his books, he had Follow Your Bliss. You know, you might want to go off and what I was doing was going off to uni to do, the library studies course because it would get me a job and that would get me money and blah, blah. But then the day that I decided I'm going to become a university dropout, I'm going to do what I want, and became a volunteer at WIS, that was when the day that I decided I'm just going to follow my bliss, I'm going to do what feels good for me. And it was really interesting that a lot of people I know who did the library studies course trying to get into the state library right at the end of it all still never got in. But I actually went and worked at WIS and from then went across sideways and ended up in the library through.
Well, we'll get to that because that's actually quite an interesting story. It's not how most people came into the library.
No.
What would you say was the main core of what WIS was about?
I feel it was being there and being available and having information and support for women. And for another thing I think that was important was letting people know that that support was there. And I guess that would have meant working with community services too. So that if a woman ended up with one community service, that service could then say, maybe have a chat with someone at WIS and find out where else you can get help. So I just see it as being a catalyst, a jumping off point, and also an extension of so many things for women who needed help.
It's often said it was for women, run by women, and it had a very strong feminist ethos. Did you feel that?
I would never have said that I was a strong feminist. I just believed that everybody had a right to a fair go and to be given the help that they could. Yes, I felt that there were feminists, and a feminist, I guess, can be seen to be different things to different people. And there was a time when a feminist was seen as a very strong, forthright, kind of not even perhaps demanding kind of person, whereas I can be perhaps introverted, but in the best sense of the word, as opposed to extrovert. So I was much more, my approach was much perhaps quieter. I don't know whether it reminds me of perhaps walk softly and carry a big stick. So I was sort of one of those that was very quietly and gently working towards a fair go for everyone, no matter who they were, rather than being out marching on the street. And I guess we needed both.
But you were clearly still a feminist.
Yes, in my sense of the
word.
You
understood that it was a much wider definition of feminism, and
absolutely,
you clearly were, because it'd be a bit boring if we all did it the same way.
Absolutely.
So you, and that reflects on your type of client, because they're coming from all cross sections of society. What were some of, they probably haven't changed a lot, but what were some of the major issues confronting women then?
Back then, I think it was domestic violence comes to mind, and getting themselves in, or being put in situations, I should say, where, and I think that was something I very soon learned, was people say, oh, they're in a bad situation, why didn't they leave? And learning that it's not that simple. It's a very complex thing, and it can be sometimes equally dangerous to leave as it can be to stay. So I learned a lot of, those kinds of things, I think. So, yes, domestic violence, helping women to be aware that that's what the name of it was, and it wasn't their fault. Those kinds of things. And I guess stemming from that, perhaps women not having money, being in situations where they needed help financially and how to get themselves out of bad situations there. I don't know, that's the thing that came to mind.
How did you help?
Firstly, I think listening and unpacking what it was, letting them tell their story and then picking the threads and getting them to think about different areas, different lines that they could follow up, and helping them to know that they could have strength and power through themselves, through going and getting these different avenues. It was never, always believed that it was never my role to be a saviour and that the person was a victim. It was always going to be that I would provide knowledge on perhaps avenues they could follow. Now, whether they followed those was very much their decision.
What you've just said well and truly summarises what I think the role of an information officer was. Were you trained that that was what you should be doing with people, or did that come quite naturally to you? As the words that you used was listen and unpack.
Oh, okay. I think really that's my inner core and what I believe. Mm. And so that came very naturally and very easily to me.
Now, there must have been cases where you felt a bit lost and didn't really know what to do. Would you go to one of the paid staff for help in those situations?
Oh, definitely, yes.
I'm sure you're quite capable of doing most of it, but there must have been cases that you needed to talk out and say, What do I say to this woman? That sort of thing. Did you have any like that that were just a little bit too hard?
I can't remember ever putting the phone on hold and going to anyone.
So you always had enough confidence to be able to.
Yeah, I think I did. I think I did. Oh, but there would have been definitely would have been times when I would have gone and debriefed with somebody, because I think that's really important. To go and say this is how it was, and I think when I was working there too as a paid staff member, and when I was training, and I always made it really clear that, you know, and there was always a paid staff person sitting with the volunteers, that the minute that something becomes a little bit uncomfortable, just pass that call on. Don't continue if you're starting to feel like you're spiralling down and you're getting a little bit lost.
What percentages of your inquiries were by phone compared to coming in person? People coming in personally?
Oh, gosh, I would say maybe 85-90%. It was a lot more people on the phone. And, wondering why, and I guess because of the anonymity of it. I think it takes more courage to come in rather than just call from a place that's a bit more familiar to you. And I guess the other thing is, God, I do a lot of guessing, don't I?
No, but that's what you're doing, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And I guess too that it also means they feel safer, because if they're coming from a position where they are a bit afraid of being found out or something like that, then to come in, especially when WIS left the Institute building and went down to the railway station, it was a very public little fishbowl, really.
Anyone walking past could see them. It was the first thing you got when you came into the arcade, wasn't it?
Yeah. So, you know, obviously we worked around that by having, you know, we could take someone out of the public view, but they still had to come in there. So I guess there are a lot of reasons why a phone call's easier.
Can you describe the actual setup of the room? I can remember going in there, but what memories spring to your mind when you describe it?
In the Institute building?
Yeah.
In the Institute building? I remember that we used to come through that front door, so we had those big doors that we went through that you pushed a button and they open, and then you came in and you went in. Yeah, I remember. That's interesting. It's so many years ago, and yet I can now visualise the manager's office was there, like immediately opposite the front door. And then there were the volunteer desks around and the paid staff. Yeah, I remember it.
What were your, what's the word I'm looking for? Resources, the brochures, the information. What was that like then?
Probably the printed brochures would have had more of a role than these days. There might be more online stuff, whereas back then I think we depended on paper, the paper brochures, so there would have been a lot more of those. I imagine there would have been more, you know, brochure racks and that kind of thing that we would show people.
So I've got a list of questions. I should actually make sure I do ask you some of these. We've done a lot of that. What was your interaction like with the rest of the staff? Like, it's clear you've got paid staff and you've got volunteers and you're all women. And I'm looking at my own experience here. I often find an all-female environment one of the best to work in.
Yes.
But it can create problems as well. So overall, what was the work environment like?
The work environment... So there's different pockets. There's the switchboard when it was here. And I think then it was a little bit different because we were, I wouldn't use the word cloistered, but it was closer to being cloistered because it was a much more private area. Whereas then we did go to the railway arcade. And of course that was much more open. So I feel like I really liked being here or being in the Institute building. It just felt like it was quite a haven for women, really. Whereas the other one was all a little bit more, I hesitate to say glitzy and glamorous, but it actually did win design awards or something for the architect that designed it, even though it wasn't half as comfortable as the, you know, like the desk, the front reception desk was designed in a way that I used to continually keep bumping the security button under there with my knees because it was too low, but it looked amazing. But it used to, gosh, back in those days, I used to wear those black sort of legging things and I was always sort of, you know, getting pulls and tags and I'd be looking up and there'd be the security guard saying, I'd go, hi, how are you? And he'd go, are you in trouble? And I'd go, no.
Didn't even know you'd knocked it.
He'd go, you've done it again, you know, so...
Quick response, though.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah, they were always there very, very fast. But I did love it here.
I remember going back to Carmel, she said one of the first things that she did when she was there, she got a coffee pot and put it on the counter.
So when women
came in, they had that lovely smell of coffee.
Yes, that would be Carmel. She was wonderful. You know, we'd be needing to send out brochures and she'd say, right, everybody in the office and we'll all get stuck into this and so we'd all sit around and we'd laugh and chat and stuff the envelopes and there was one thing that Carmel gave me which she wouldn't know, but one thing I never forgot and I always used from then on was she would sometimes need to interview people and then after she said to me once, you know, there's a trick to interviewing that makes it very simple. And she said, I learned it many years ago and she said, when people come in, I'm not interested in asking them anything about their CVs or resumes because I can read that. I've seen all that. And they can rehearse themselves and they can come and tell me all this. And she said, I'll find out all that I need to know from reading the information they've given me. She said, the one thing that breaks through all of that and tells me whether they're the kind of person I want to be working with is the question, okay, now, would you like to share something from your life that you found particularly challenging or particularly rewarding? And she said, suddenly that person, the everything just fell away and they picked a challenge or they picked a rewarding, satisfying experience and they became themselves. They weren't a rehearsed person anymore. They were themselves. And that saved me afterwards on a number of occasions, selecting someone who was really good for the job over someone that you'd think, oh, I'm glad I asked that question because now it's all poured out.
So I've that, just added that to my list of questions. That's actually brilliant advice,
isn't it? It's brilliant. So, yeah, thank you, Carmel.
And
it was brilliant.
That's something you carried with you for the rest of your life since,
yeah,
isn't it?
Right through to the library too. Always used that. Yeah, it was a saving grace. Yeah.
You're just sitting here smiling at you. I can tell how much you obviously loved working there.
I did.
There were lots of highs and lows in organisations like that. But also it was an organisation that was new and having lots of successes. What sort of thing did you do as a team or as a group of people to celebrate those successes? Did you do anything?
Yeah, we seem to, and this is now probably up when we were in the Rawa Arcade and up on the, is it sixth floor?
Yeah, where we were the office.
Yeah. So I remember there was a lot of celebrations in Carmel's office. You know, something would go well or we'd need to commiserate something and we'd all troop into Carmel's office and, she'd sort of have some afternoon tea or something would appear out of nowhere. And she was always smiling and we'd get in there and it was just a really nice place to be. So that when I think of celebrating, I think Carmel's office comes to mind the most. Parlamentos, we used to duck down to Parlamentos every now and again. There were a few luncheons there that went on a little. And so that was always pretty
good. They were also very good at parties where they'd invite the right people, politicians, movers and shakers. And I remember going through, it might have even been the 30th anniversary, looking through a lot of those photo albums. And one of the mistakes that we'd made was we forgot to record who all of those people were. And so that's still an ongoing issue, the number of people that provided that support, maybe not in money, but provided the support for the organisation.
Oh, absolutely.
Because it was set up by Don Dunstan and it was continuing that, which leads me to ask you, what were the type of clients you had? We know what their needs were. Mm. Domestic violence probably still one of the biggest out there, lots of home crisis issues and things like that. So where were these people coming from? What sort of people were they?
Probably a lot of the people, look, from all ranges, areas, everywhere. People came from everywhere. But I think maybe some people from particular areas didn't look for help because they may have been aware of their position and didn't want to be seen to be needing help. So they may not have, where people from other areas may have been more from a culture where they had called for help and would call for help. And so it was good that they were able to do that, where perhaps some women who would have really needed the help but felt they couldn't
I'm
do it.
I'm thinking the same thing, particularly with domestic violence. If you're from a, let's say, inverted commas, proper family or a higher part of society, not too good to admit that.
Exactly. Mm. And the fear of, you know, there's always fear no matter which part of the echelons of society you're in. But sometimes it can be a different kind of fear of maybe even having them feeling they may have more to lose on different levels than someone who didn't have a lot in the first place. So there were a whole lot of different fears and,
And again, I think it's probably not changed a lot.
I'm sure it probably hasn't.
The internet came into being in the early 90s. Now, that certainly changed your role.
Mm.
How did that impact on WIS? Were you there for that changeover?
Yeah, that was a huge change. And I remember there was a place, and I can't remember the name of it, but it was where they had different databases or something that had lists of all the community services and that kind of thing. With the changeover to the internet, that changed so that was more freely available to all, but a lot of people didn't know exactly how to get into it or access it. So that's where we had to still be there. It was still important to be there and to know how to decipher and how to get through to that.
And I remember, I've lost track of when, but again, sometime in the early 90s, that WIS actually did training sessions for women on how to use the computer.
Oh, yes.
and the freedom that that gave people to have that resource.
Yes, I can remember that. And I remember we had, I think, 4 or 5 computers in a circular desk set up that was down in the railway arcade. And I remember there were some women who wanted to always sit at the back so people wouldn't see them learning the internet, you know. And it was marvellous because they could have one-on-one. And it was coming from women who weren't IT specialists. We weren't IT specialists.
They were ordinary women.
They were ordinary women that could just say, oh, well, this works for me. How about we try that? And it was sort of sometimes working together.
Both learning
together.
And that must have been such a strength because women are often intimidated by new technology, and a lot of these women weren't in the workplace.
Yes.
So not even having that opportunity to be taught by a fellow learner to a degree would be quite confidence building in them. One of the things I remember about WIS is they all seem to be having constant projects or big phone-ins on particular issues. Were you involved in any of those sorts of things?
I was, but not to a huge degree. That's not one thing that really sticks in my mind.
Maybe that...
Yeah, it was there. And maybe it doesn't stick in my mind because maybe I more enjoyed the one-on-one, the working the phones, the helping, the training, all that kind of thing.
So what time period were you there? So you started maybe around 90. Mm-hmm. How long did you work? Because you were here for the move down to Station Arcade.
Yes.
So how many years were you there?
I might have been, I reckon I must have moved to the library around 90. So maybe for 5 or 6 years before that, perhaps.
So it was a substantial period, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Now your role changed within that from a volunteer.
Yeah.
So let's talk through that process.
It's really wonderful. And like I say, it's just such a classic example of follow your bliss, don't do what you think's going to get you money or standing or anything like that. Just do what you want.
Well, I should have asked a question. As a volunteer, how were you surviving to live? Because you had a couple of kids and...
Yeah, I had kids and I was...
age ranges between the kids? Were they...
Well,
when the time you were working there?
Oh, gosh, when I was working there, they must have been... from about 9 to 14-ish, maybe, somewhere in there.
So that's a full-time mum job, isn't it?
Well, it was, when I look back and I can think, how did I do that? Because I was renovating an old late 1800s cottage down at Hove as well, so, you know, it was a busy time, but, you know.
If you want something done, ask a busy person.
Well, exactly. But, I became a volunteer there. That was wonderful. And then...
So it's still a bit of a juggling act, but you managed to get to complement the family life, the renovation, and working all quite well.
Yes. And then some casual work came up, and I was lucky enough to get the casual work, and I was pretty excited about that.
As an information officer? Or...
Yes, yeah. And then from that, a contract position became available. So I got a contract position, which I think was renewed maybe 3 times. And I think after that, there was something, well, you couldn't go for it again. They had to call a position, or there was, you know, some government thing. And then, of course, I was over the moon because I actually won the position. So,
do you remember who interviewed you? I'm always curious.
I reckon by that time, it would have been Margaret Porter, mm-hmm. who was just another magic woman. She came in, I think, after Vaya, and absolutely loved working for Marg. She was warm and jolly, and I think she was from Yorkshire, and she had an amazing accent, and she was, they were all wonderful. Mm-hmm. So I worked with Marg very closely, got on really well with her. Got on well with all of them. It was just a marvellous thing to go from.
Was that a full-time position when you...
Yeah, that was full-time,
And within that, you took on another fairly substantial role in training, didn't you?
Yes.
How did that happen?
I realised that I loved the volunteer position, and then I started sort of working with volunteers, and then through WIS they offered that I could go and do the Diploma of Volunteer Management through Volunteering SA, and I actually went through with the very first inaugural volunteer diploma in volunteer management that was run through Volunteering SA, which was wonderful. So I did that. They were just so supportive and kind enough to put me through that, and came out with my diploma, and so then coordinated the program, moved it in in new directions and or in whatever. And then I guess it was natural that in that then training would be part of that role, and I absolutely loved that. And then I did a series of handbooks, which I'm sure have been superseded many years ago, but that was just a brilliant project that I did to look at how we train, to rewrite the whole, or introduce a really structured training program where people came in with proper workbooks, information books, books that had trial scenarios that they could go away and do them themselves and write down what they would do, and then we could discuss after what other options might have been. And so by the time they actually became fully fledged volunteers, they had a pretty good grounding in possibilities and options that you could suggest to women.
And most of those skills you got from that training course? Or it was?
Yes, yes.
But it would have also used the skills from your university degree, your life experience. I mean, you don't just suddenly invent a training program without substantial life training as well as the dynamics of how to put it together.
Yeah, definitely. And also having been a volunteer there and an information officer there for a while and knowing what women were coming looking for, or maybe didn't even know what they were looking for until you started to unpack and talk with them. So, yeah, that was... And the training also involved people, professionals from outside. I remember we had someone from Disability Action come in, or actually we went out there actually, and one thing that stuck in my mind was putting on headphones and having an experience of what it's like to be schizophrenic and hear voices in your head. And so through the headphones, while somebody else in person was trying to have a conversation or attempting to have a conversation with you, you were hearing these voices putting you down and swearing at you and being terrible to you in your head, and you were trying to cope with that and at the same time have a conversation with a real person in front of you. And now, from then on, it just gave me such a bit of an insight into what a struggle some people have in their lives, how difficult it is, and I just respect people so much for that now.
Shame more people couldn't get access to that sort of training.
Oh, absolutely.
You couldn't possibly imagine unless they should have that.
Yeah, it just opened my eyes so much. And I would organise, like someone came in from crisis care and talked to us particularly about calls that might come through with someone who was talking about, life becoming too much and not wanting to go on with it. How do you cope with that? That's probably the most... confronting thing to have on the phone, and just feeling that weight of responsibility. What if I get this wrong? What could be the outcome? Having that person come in and talk to us, that was just wonderful. People from domestic violence, the domestic violence unit, those kinds of people, just so many amazing people who came in and talked to us.
And so you would get that training for all the staff?
Yeah, yeah.
And now I'm guessing it's probably expanded into lots of other areas too. things that you probably hadn't even thought of back then. But
yeah,
that's one of the strengths of the organisation. It still grows. It still provides services a lot more now for victims of international crimes and coming in as refugees and things like that, which wouldn't have happened in your time. But, I mean, I'm sure that's something that the current WISA doing. And also now they're doing a lot of country visits. Was that anything that happened in your time, going up and providing information sessions to country?
They may have. I can't remember.
So not a large part of it was? And
not for me it wasn't. But you saying about the refugees just reminded me, and her name escapes me at the moment, but she was another magic woman. She was South American, and it was about the time when genital mutilation was just becoming known, and she worked in that area with a lot of people. I can't remember.
I've got lots of names here. I'm just
terrible.
Looking to see. It occurred to me someone did mention a South American woman, but it's not coming quickly to my head either.
Yeah, she was just wonderful, and she was such a treasure because she could understand, whereas perhaps from our very safe, secure Adelaide base, we hadn't been confronted with something like that. Well, I hadn't been anyway. And then suddenly that opened up a whole new area of like, oh, this really happens and people do suffer through this. So, yeah, it was wonderful having her. And, yes, she did a lot of outreach and went out to a lot of women's groups and talked.
We're quickly running out of time. I can't believe how quickly that's gone. the women's support group, the WIS support group. Were you aware of that? I know you wouldn't have necessarily attended it, but did you know what their role was or who was involved with that?
Yeah, there was a woman, and I can't remember her name, but she used to wear her hair pulled back in a very small bun, and she was very committed to the support group, and I can't remember her name, but I do remember that support group. And one thing I have remembered that I would like to say was that I always felt that we were there very much, of course, for women, but we were also there to help men who needed to understand that women needed help and why things might be the way they were. And I can remember once a chap coming in, and he was quite heated, and he was saying, "Oh, you women, you're dividing, you know, women from their husbands, and you're doing this and you're doing that." And I remember walking out from the phones area and starting to talk to him, and can't remember exactly the conversation, but he was so distressed and so upset and felt that we were dividing people. And I just started talking to him and saying things like, "Look, you know, I can't remember exactly, but something like, look, it sounds like you really care about your wife." And he was saying, "Of course I care about my wife. I love my wife deeply." And I was saying, "Yeah, and we care about women deeply the way that you care about your wife." And we just had this conversation that I could just see him starting to soften in front of me. And it makes me go a bit goosey right at this moment to remember that, how this person who came in with so much angst and so angry just ended up, just we had this lovely conversation, and then he said, "Oh, you know what?" And I think it was something like at the end, he said, "You know what?" He said, "You Sheilas aren't half bad after all," or something like that, you know.
And
I wasn't going to go into, "Well, actually, I'm not sure that we're Sheilas, but
you
I
knew
just
what
thought,
he was saying.
Win."
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I just thought, wow, we've got through that. He's gone out thinking we're okay. He doesn't feel threatened by us now.
And also, he would talk to other men.
Yes.
So the message continued.
Yes.
Now, we've already talked about who the directors were in your time. Do you remember who the ministers were or the women's advisors of those times?
Di Laidlaw was the minister. I don't remember any other anything.
She would have been there for a while. Yeah.
It was Di Laidlaw. Yeah. I remember her.
And we had women's advisors around.
Yeah, I remember she had very dark hair, and she still Is it Vicky Chapman, I think?
No, she wouldn't have been women's advisor. She would have...
She was... I think she was involved in some way.
Oh, okay. I think she was actually on the support group as well.
That might have
been
what it was.
She was very supportive of the organisation. Yeah. Yeah. Now, the very last question. You can answer the question that you were taught to ask about challenging yourself. The question that you were taught to ask by Carmel.
Oh, yes.
Now you can answer it.
In what way?
What's been your biggest challenge, your biggest reward?
Oh, my biggest challenge. Isn't that interesting?
Isn't it?
Isn't it interesting? My biggest challenge.
Because I couldn't answer it on the spot either.
I guess my biggest challenge in my life, there's been a lot of challenges. Probably my biggest challenge was packing up three kids and one of their kids who my son came home from high school and just said, oh, can we take so-and-so with us? I thought, oh, well, if I've got three, I might as well have four. So coming over with four country kids, going to uni as quite a shy, you know, person from the country, renovating a cottage, and then being a dropout from uni, you know, I mean,
so
all
that,
of those,
that whole package,
whole package
is
was quite a challenge. But, yeah.
And what's the things that you take away from WIS in your time there that you've taken on to your future employment?
I think being aware of the worth of women, that, yeah, it sounds a bit cliche to say that women have a voice and they should be able to speak that voice, and you can drop back into cliches. But I think what I've taken away from there is a confidence in myself as being a woman, and also a respect and knowing, I think, when I was saying about that man explaining to him or talking to him and saying, it's not women aren't here to be against men. We're here for understanding across all areas. Yeah.
That's something pretty good to take with you.
Yeah.
And just finally, why did you leave and what were the circumstances that led you to leave a job that you loved?
Oh, okay. That is a story in itself that would take about 5 hours, but let's
just say... Well, give me the two-minute version.
The two-minute version, I guess there was always something about books and the whole library and writing and English and everything, and maybe it was just because of a whole set of circumstances that happened. Sometimes life leads you in another direction that you didn't even know was going to happen. Doors start closing here, they start opening there, and you just move on because the time's right.
And I think it's inspirational that you ended up as a volunteer coordinator.
Yes.
At the State Library. I think that just sums up your role in a beautiful way.
Yeah.
And I have run out of time, so thank you very much for today. That was a fabulous interview. I really enjoyed hearing your stories.
Thank you. I loved all the memories.
Thank you. Good. I'm delighted. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.